Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, a weekly comic snapcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka. Every week, we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. And of course, before we get into anything else, I need to welcome Mr. Jason Poliev, good buddy and co-host to the Tesseract. How are you doing this week?
I'm doing great, Justin. How are you doing?
I am doing fantastic, and I'll tell you why. It's kind of personal, but I'm going to explain why.
What do we got going on?
Well, tonight, my wife and I are going to get to do something that we've been waiting to do for a long, long time. It's the type of thing that involves taking the lights down, lighting up some candles, getting some nice, you know, mood kind of going. Both get to hop into bed, curl up under a nice warm blanket, and watch Thor and Captain America back to back. Yeah.
Red box, huh?
Oh, gotta love it. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Netflix in a way that it should be illegal for a man to love an anthropomorphized version of a film delivery service. But Redbox is awesome. I mean, the fact that, and we've been doing this for the past couple weeks. There have been a couple good things that we missed in the theaters because we have a kid. We can't really do the theater thing. So it's nice to be able to finally pick these things up and actually watch them and enjoy them. In fact, we may not watch them back to back. Probably won't have enough time to, but if we do, awesome. If not, I think we'll do it chronologically. We'll probably watch Thor first and then hit Cap tomorrow.
And by chronologically, you mean the way that they came out in theaters?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, right. not like actual chronology of World War II and sometime out in the middle of the desert. But on the topic of Marvel, because I don't think they want to hear me talk anymore about what happens between me and my wife in our bedroom, let's talk about Age of Apocalypse.
Okay.
This was new this week, the number one issue, but I can say with all certainty this is not the beginning of the story.
No, and that was one of the things that frustrated me. I knew this actually came, I mean, it even says it across the top for the pages of Uncanny X-Force.
Right.
But, yeah, and, you know, many of you may recall they had a Age of Apocalypse arc that had gone through the X-Men years ago, which is where the world that this takes place in.
That Age of Apocalypse, it's been talked about, it's been hit back and forth many times.
Yeah.
The Cable that's currently in X-Sanction, I think, comes from this, or maybe one of these alternate futures. I don't know if it is the Age of Apocalypse future or if it's one that's just very, very like it.
Well, Marvel continuity is really kind of screwy. And, yeah, you have this, which is actually an alternate Earth, which DC said, oh, wait, that's going to confuse people, and got rid of them. Then they brought them back. Then they changed them all up again.
Yeah.
So, to some extent, Marvel's kept their stuff. However, yeah, just pull up the Wikipedia entry for Kang the Conqueror and try reading that.
Yeah.
Try and keep straight what time he went back and forth and where he needed to go and how he discovered he needed to do what to keep himself alive in which time zones.
That's any time travel story. I mean, if you get into something like, there's
more than one single story that you start dealing with. But actually back to this, which takes place on its own alternate Earth and reality, which actually picks up right where Uncanny X-Force left off. And this actually does a fairly good job of introducing you to each of the characters, or at least the main characters of this world.
And kind of their current situation, too. It does a good job in the story of explaining, okay, you are this person, this is what's going on, you're here. You're this person, here's what's going on with you. And that's, you know, and they set all that up very well. However, I will say, and much to Marvel's defense, they have that little paragraph on the intro page that gives you the story so far.
Yeah,
that thing saved my life on this book, because had I not read that, I'd have been utterly lost.
Yeah,
because this really is a world on its ear from what people know of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
You have Wolverine as bad guy, Jean Grey, who's
his wife.
Yeah, who's his wife,
now depowered, which depowered
and on opposite sides of the Force because he's gone off. Yeah, Wolverine has gone off on some weird power trip thing after killing Apocalypse.
I don't think that killed Apocalypse. Apocalypse is dead in this world, but he was one of Apocalypse's alkalites. just as in the traditional Marvel universe, Angel became Archangel as became an Alkalite. Wolverine became
one of the Horsemen, yeah?
One of the Horsemen, yes. Yeah. Wolverine was the Horseman, I believe it was actually was Death in the original Age of Apocalypse story arc.
I imagine he would have been War. That just seems to fit his personality better.
So, yeah. And he's actually missing a hand, which is an interesting little twist since does have his healing factor and everything. Yeah, there's...
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah, this does just kind of flip the whole world on its ear. Sabretooth is actually a good guy.
Big character in this, too.
Yeah, and they've made him more, not necessarily a good guy, but definitely not a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the explanation of this world is Apocalypse led the mutants in a revolution against the humans, saying, we are the next stage of evolution, we will take center stage.
And you guys are out.
Yeah, and so the basic plan was to wipe out the entire human race.
Right.
Leaving nothing but mutants.
And did a pretty fair job, I gotta say.
Yeah, and this story is actually following the last group of surviving humans. Actually,
the Rebel Force, essentially.
Yeah, Battlestar Galactica and the Cylons coming after the remaining humans.
Well, in these remaining humans, there are names that I found familiar, like Bolivar Trask.
Yes.
Like William Stryker.
Right, both of whom have lobbied for the Sentinel program and been actively working against mutants in the regular continuity.
Right. Which makes sense they would fall into this sort of role in this type of world. But there are other names that they brought up that were completely foreign to me. I don't know if they were foreign to the X-Men universe, and they exist only in this timeline, or...
Some may be, Creed's son is actually in here. Victor Creed, who is Sabretooth, son is in here, and is actually fighting on the side of humans, because that was actually a big story arc in the traditional universe of Sabretooth being against his son because his son was a human, not a mutant.
Okay.
That was a big thing for him to deal with. It was kind of that reverse of, oh my god, my son is a mutant, what do I do?
Yeah, now it's, oh my god, my son is a human.
Yeah, I can't accept him. Yeah.
Right.
So it was a big switch with that, and here he is fighting with the Rebels.
Which you should mention, Sabretooth is depowered as well, alongside with Jean. They both got depowered in the same event.
Yeah, that happened at during the Uncanny X-Force run. So,
okay.
I actually started reading this book and stopped and put it down and put it aside.
What was that?
I don't know if it was that difficult for me to grasp. I'd just been reading a couple of other books and it was like, okay, time to shut off and do something different. Stop reading comics. And I just picked this book up as the last in that reign. It was going, nope, not going to process this.
I did that with a different book this week. I did that with Action. But I did that because it's actually two separate stories, and after the first story, I'm like, I just put it to the side.
Well, but at least you were between stories. I actually got halfway through the intro of this, actually probably three quarters of the way through introducing all the characters, and set this aside and said, I need to find something else to do. I picked it back up, reread it from the beginning, and got through it fine, and I don't know if that helped me accept it easier. Maybe put me in a better mindset for this, because it is very much way out left field if you've not been following what's currently going on with Uncanny X-Force and staying current on the event, or read the previous Age of Apocalypse story.
Which I think you did, yeah?
No.
I have not. From the explanation of it, it sounded like you had. I had not either, and I agree. I mean, this thing is way out in left field, so I would think anybody that's coming to this book, like we have, should be forewarned that this is going to rattle your cage. I mean, especially if you do know, and most people do know, at least the sort of core zeitgeist of the X-Men universe, as far as, how these characters fit together. And
it doesn't matter for this.
Yeah. I mean, pick this up expecting just, I don't know if you want to call it like an X-Men alt history. It's kind of maybe a best way to explain it.
It's not even an X-Men alt history. It's a different Earth. And there were a couple of things in here that were kind of interesting. It talks, part of this, it actually goes back and talks about how the person who's telling you the story, who's a reporter, gets brought to this world. He's actually from a different world.
He's from the Prime Marvel Universe, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah. He's from Marvel Prime, and he's brought to this world, which actually made me kind of go, wait, what? For something that's revealed at the end of this with a character.
Yeah. Yeah.
They reveal a character and you're going, but he would be familiar with that character, would know a couple of things that he's playing dumb about or does, or just not registering, because he does, yeah, because he is from our traditional, whereas, yeah, he's been moved to this alternate world. And so he's seeing things like, Murdoch, Matt Murdoch, who in Earth Prime is Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
And here he's known.
He's an enforcer for Wolverine's regime.
Yes.
Which is interesting because he is in fact not a mutant, but he has powers similar to those of a mutant, so they kind of let him slide.
Yeah, and he's known as Keeper Murdoch, and he keeps the people, you know, running the way that they're supposed to be running.
Or at least that this world feels they should be.
Overall, I think they did a decent job in trying to introduce you to a deep, deep world that if you are unfamiliar with, it's going to be very hard to grasp.
Yeah. I do think this is going to be a fun ride, though. I think it's going to be interesting. Let me rephrase that. For the majority of this book, I thought there's no way I'm going to pick up number two. And then it gets to the end and you have that reveal and I felt, okay, this could be interesting. So I'm looking forward to the rest of these. I'll pick them up. I think I'll enjoy them. The only thing that I think will deter me from this book is if it remains as rocky as this intro was. Like if it keeps plot wise, having to reveal, like, just little across the entire thing that I have to fight at it, I'm not going to enjoy it.
Yeah, well, part of this is I'm not sure what the point of this story is. The point actually is these are the humans fighting against the mutant oppressors. But I haven't been given a single mission that's going to be happening in this.
Yeah, it kind of feels more almost like another chapter of the story.
Yeah, but what is the, you know, goal? When they do a TV show, yeah, that's typically the monster of the week, which comics have moved away from doing a monster of the week in that you get a one and done story arc.
Well, no, but the monster of the week is now the monster of the 6 month run that will become the trade.
But I don't know what that 6 month monster is.
Right. Which the reveal at the end might, I think, is a lead into it. But you're right, they never revealed it in this book, which is to its detriment, definitely.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not that, you know, everything has to have that, you know, overarching larger plot, but I need something to make me want to try and move forward.
Mm-hmm.
I also was reading this.
Was that reveal at the end just not enough for you for that?
I'm really torn because, like you, from a lot of this, I wasn't that interested in keeping on, and by the end of it, I'm kind of going, what is going to happen next, though?
So it has that intrigue.
There's something
the hook is there.
But I don't know. It's not set. Yeah, they could try and reel me in in that next issue, and the hook's going to fly out.
Yeah.
So I need to know. I need a little meat to grab onto of this is the big baddie that we're going after. And, and the overarching story of
they've
we're going
after.
They've
got the hook, but not the bait.
Yeah. And it seems to me the overarching story of mutants versus humans is too thin to, you know,
to hold for a full series.
Yeah, to hold, they're going to be going on and on with this for, that's, once you do that premise, where do you go from there? Are you going to tell the story of the rebuild? So there's not much, you know that's what's going to happen, but I don't see a stairway leading me towards that.
Do we know at all if this is going to in any way tie back to any like the Generation Hope stuff or what's leading in with the Avengers versus X-Men stuff?
I was trying to figure out if this is an ongoing, if this is a mini.
I don't know that either.
I'm thinking it's got to be an ongoing because there's no indication that this is a mini. Now, it could be a maxi, which is just 12 issues and done.
Maybe.
But they haven't indicated
how
it's going to go.
Yeah, there's no of whatever on it. So.
Yeah,
I don't know.
So,
next one to kind of bring up quick, and this is going to be quick because we talked about this a little bit beforehand, is Vale and the Outcast from Boom Studios. And you and I both, if this is, I don't want to call it I don't want to call it a guilty pleasure because there's nothing really guilty, well, except for, you have a different color cover than I do. I don't know who has what. Oh, I have the B cover.
I have the A cover.
You got the A cover.
Yeah.
The B cover definitely has, it's a B cover with a D cup. So.
Yeah, it's selling a bit of the sex on there. Mine's not quite so much.
Yeah. Sex, blood, need a little bit of drugs and rock and roll, and I think we'll be good to go on this one.
But Well, if you just want all that type of stuff, go pick up Ferals, because that's got the sex, it's got the gore.
Oh, man.
And they're actually starting to use some of that to, there's actually story points as to why they're showing you the sex. And while the gore is not quite as much of a story point, there are parts that where you're kind of going, I understand why I need to see this.
Yeah.
So
you need to understand how horrific it needs to be.
Right. They're building.
Fire.
Yeah. At the end of the second issue, there was like, okay, didn't really see that coming, but it's something that I expect to see done.
Yeah, but see,
that's
the whole reason that I dropped it.
The third one, they're now going, okay, this is much deeper than what they've presented in the first two issues. So, there's a lot more going on in this book.
I thought you were talking about there's more going on with the gore and the sex. And
well, it still has that.
How deep can gore and sex go? I mean, granted, I know it can get kind of dark, but,
There are fetish sites for that. But back to actually Valen. And,
yeah.
Cause this has been a fun ride. And you've got some great characters in this book.
Oh God, yeah. And the roguish character shines in this issue like nobody else. Oh man, he's phenomenal. He is just he's an unrepentant dick, but he's too busy getting the crap kicked out of him to really be that big of a dick.
How he's being a dick, you won't tell him what they want to know.
Even after they bring up the whole, like,
The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, the Wrath of Khan bug thing. But yeah. This one goes in his stomach as opposed to his ear, and it's going to eat his way out of his guts. Oh, man.
Yeah, so, this one, it has some nice little, we're going to twist your stomach with making you feel uncomfortable moments.
Oh, yeah.
And that wasn't even the most uncomfortable moment.
No, the most uncomfortable probably came after that. But the story remains good. I mean, the plot line is still there. It's following a good narrative. You have a good confrontation with a big bad guy in this one, so you have a nice, solid battle scene. And it's humorous. I mean, there's little quips and things thrown in. I particularly like the handshake during the battle.
Yeah, but there's also, they're actually building this world. Yeah,
I should probably just clarify. The handshake, I did air quotes, which is really a stupid thing for me to do.
Nobody can actually see that through the microphone.
Yeah, sorry. Air quotes on the handshake in battle, by the way, folks.
Yeah, which was actually the swords clanking together.
Yeah.
But with this book, they're actually doing a lot to build the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're now in a new city. We're seeing how that city operates, how that city deals with the problems that the outside world has brought to them.
Yeah, and it is very different from the other settings and scenes we've seen so far in the series.
Yes.
We've seen a lot of outland. We've seen a lot of, like, farmland. And I think there was one city where the large bridge connected to a city, but that city, I think, was overrun by the undead, if I remember correctly. Or was that different one? It wasn't.
No.
The undead ran outside trying to get in, and they ended up blowing the bridge. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so they keep showing, as they're moving through, they're showing us the breadth of this land. Each place is different. You know, and there are different groups and societies that have their own rules. In this case, was it House of Hands was the place that they were going to?
Yeah.
And, you really see, the characteristics of that group that runs the house, of the guild that lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And
a thieves guild, by the way, just to let people know. You don't need to go into it any more than that, because I think that's best left discovered.
And then there's a wonderful little piece of, at the end, that this book is foreshadowing
mm-hmm.
by introducing a character that ties into one of the main three that we're following.
Yes.
So, there's a nice little foreshadowing you're going to see. And
well, actually, two.
You don't really,
two characters introduced at the end that are like that.
Yeah. There are two.
Yeah.
But one is I think, much more of the foreshadowing. The other, I think, we're going to see much sooner. And it's not going to... It'll be impactful, but I don't think it's going to be as impactful as the other. The other can really go either way. We know the way one is going to happen.
I'll keep this in euphemism so we don't spill too much. which one do you think is going to be more impactful? The young one or the old one?
The young one.
Okay. That's what I was thinking too.
The old one, we know what they're there for. We know why they're there.
Yeah. It's
and what they're
a direct antagonizing.
And, well, we don't know the specific method. We know the way that they're going to interact.
Yeah. It's going to be antagonistic. I mean, there's really no other way to look at that.
The other one could be antagonistic. It could be friendly. It could be.
It's just, yeah. It's a nice
it could
big
be
question
a role reversals going on with that. And that's what makes that fun.
Yeah.
And we don't even know when that will actually take place.
Yeah. Or if it may just, they may leave it out there as a dangling thread just to pull it in whenever they feel is a good time for it. But we said we wanted to keep that short. So Valen's awesome. Next one we want to talk about is Detective. Detective, this is the end of the arc, which is in the 7 book, which is kind of surprising because a lot of the other DCU runs have actually ended on 6.
Well, some of them ended on 5.
A few of them stretched out, a few of them were a little bit short, but this is the longest, I think this is the only one that had, oh no, actually, come to think of it, this arc started on,
this is
a short arc. This short arc started on like 5. This is only like a 3 issue run.
Yeah, actually, you're right, because this started didn't start off from
with
the beginning.
The doll master thing.
Yeah, so this is the third of a series. It takes place right after the initial arc ends.
Yeah,
Batwing is still ongoing. Batwing just had issue 7 come out, was
and
great.
It still didn't finish the arc?
No, the arc's still not done.
Oh, good.
It'll at least be issue 8.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I want to run through the chronology and see.
Yeah.
The first detective dealt with Joker. 2, 3, and 4 dealt with the Dollmaker.
Yep.
And then 5, 6, and 7 are now dealing with Iceberg Lounge.
I'm pretty sure we got that right.
Okay. So. I want to make sure that was
it. Which, this is...
That's kind of interesting that they're doing, like, 3-issue arcs, because that doesn't fit very well into their standard put-it-in-trade kind of thing.
DC has said they're not writing for the trade, so maybe this is the example that they're going to use of, we're not writing for the trades now!
Well, which makes sense, because Detective Comics as a book... doesn't necessarily work well going into trades.
Well, you could do this as a 7-issue trade, too.
Yeah.
And that would work fine, and that's a nice sizable trade. They've done books like that before where they'll do 7, and then they'll have a little one-shot, and they may even include that one-shot with the first
Which
with that
book
arc.
Had the side story of the...
That was Detective.
That was Detective, okay.
Yeah, The boy playing poker at the end of the issue. Yes.
That was, okay. I was trying to remember if that was Detective or if that was one of the other books.
Yeah, that was a side story. That was, I think, issue 5.
Yeah, okay.
Issue
4. So that he was at the end of the previous arc, right?
It would have been so nice to actually, you know, see him come back or see a follow-up.
Yeah. Well, that's what we thought it was going to happen.
And maybe it will, maybe we'll see more of that in the next arc. Maybe. You know, we got, you know,
well,
Ed Bennis is going to be taking over artist duties shortly on this book. He'll be doing, I think, 3 issues, and then Tony Daniel will be back doing the art again. Tony Daniel's still doing the writing, but they're just getting Ed Bennis to fill in, so.
Okay.
I hope there's a lot of women in that book.
Detective's not gonna tie into the Court of Owls. The Night of the Owls that's gonna be going on across the other Bat books. Because this one's chronologically.
In theory, it's 5 years before the other Bat books. Doesn't mean that he won't necessarily run into something that ties in, but he doesn't recognize it.
You know what? It'll
be difficult to do, but...
I think I just found a continuity hitch.
There's a lot of those.
There is, but this one's a chronological one. Because if this is supposed to be 5 years before the whole Night of the Owls thing...
Right.
They mentioned in book 6, I believe, there's an aside about, to see what's going on with this, go read iVampire. iVampire is about to have its own kind of big crossover thing, with, I think it's like Son of Cain or something like that, which is going to cross over into Justice League Dark as well. So I'm curious if that means Justice League Dark is supposed to be this 5 years back, along with everything else, because I'm pretty sure that one's supposed to be up on current timeline.
It could be that the initial arc in Detective was 5 years back, and now they're back in current time. So after the initial Joker arc.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
Where Joker lost, but that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, because otherwise his face would have been stored for 5 years.
Well, we know it's been stored for
Harley's going after it.
We know it's been stored for 5 years when Harley's going after it.
Did they ever say that they've had it for that long?
They just said the Joker's disappeared, nobody's found him, and all that they have is his face. So.
Looks pretty preserved for being 5 years of dead skin.
Well, you know, it's a Joker. They put it on ice, you know.
Well, plus all the chemicals in it.
Yeah.
Preserve the hell out of it.
Then again, we don't know that it's his actual face either.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. Joker's been missing since the beginning. Yeah. DC's had a huge continuity problem. Not necessarily in, you know, the idea of this, you know, detective action. And taking place 5 years before, Justice League taking place somewhere around 3 years,
right,
and everything else in current continuity.
Which we know Justice League is going to take a huge step forward with the next issue. Next issue is going to be, okay, we are now in current time.
Yeah. DC has just done a horrible job of letting you know this is 5 years before, now it's back to current, or any of that, with the books that have been in the past. They've done a horrid job with letting fans know that.
I agree.
And I think it's really, you know, to their detriment and screwed with some people on that.
Well, because I'm wondering, I still think we're going to see that they're going to goof it up somewhere. There's, I mean, just because
if they
of
have
the sheer,
already.
And they probably have, and I'm just not picking out a specific example yet.
We are, because we're talking about, you know, his face. How long has the Joker been missing? Is it 5 years? Because Harley hasn't been, the Suicide Squad, in theory, hasn't been around for 5 years. Current continuity.
Well, we're supposed to be seeing more about Harley's past in the next few books, too. So we might see, like, maybe the reason she split and she's off doing her own thing and got picked up to be in the Suicide Squad is because of Joker's disappearance.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, well, that means Harley had to have been around before, we had Superman and before Batman revealed himself to the public, because he only revealed himself to the public about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of a history do these characters have before Superman steps out? And, because Superman stepping out was supposed to be, he's the first superhero. Yeah. There weren't supervillains before that.
I mean, that being the case, let's look
Batman
at Green Lantern.
Batman was working in the shadows before that and now stepped out. Well, Green Lantern would have come, shortly after. Yeah, that's why I think Justice League was probably about 3 years prior to the current continuity.
As opposed to the full five.
Because that gives you 2 years to have Flash, Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, Aquaman all show up on the scene, start making their appearances now after Superman and Batman, who Batman, they've said, was working in the shadows beforehand.
Yeah.
Just stepped out to it after Superman. So he was actually around before Superman. Nobody knew about it, though.
Right.
Which gives you the timeline for how he had Robin. And the other Robin.
Yeah.
Possibly the other Robin. We don't know how deep those Robins go.
But at least three of them in the universe as it is, so.
Well, four. You got Dick Grayson.
Yeah.
You've got Jason Todd.
Right.
You've got Tim Drake. And you've got Damian Wayne.
Damian, yeah.
So.
I forgot about the piss hand.
Yep.
Gee, can't imagine why.
So.
Alright.
Well, DC continuity screwed. But back to what goes on in this book.
Okay.
I actually didn't like the previous issue of this arc. There wasn't much that happened. I felt.
There was a lot happening, there was a lot going on, but there was nothing happening.
Yeah. And this one things actually progressed. I actually liked the way the last one ended was with Batman in an elevator being caved in on with ice, and that's where this one picks up.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually liked the way that they used that ice to actually say it had putting her in hypothermia had actually saved the reporter's life.
Right.
That actually, I liked that aspect of this story.
Mm-hmm.
I liked how when Bruce says, send me the bat boat, and it crashes in there, you see in various parts throughout the casino, people going,
was that an
explosion?
Yeah.
So I liked that
the
that
casino
was tied
rattles
in.
And stuff. Yeah, that was kind of neat.
Yeah. So I liked that they tied that all together as opposed to just playing on the assumption, oh, but people will assume that happened and go on.
Mm-hmm. I will say the one thing that still irked me about this book it irked me through this entire little three issue arc is the rogue gallery. The fact that you have this collection of what are supposed to be these bad guys that really look like a bunch of freaking clowns. I mean, they look like schmucks.
Have you looked at Batman's Rogues Gallery? A lot of them do.
I know.
The Calculator's original costume
was a calculator.
Yes.
I know. Could have been an abacus.
So, you've got...
How corny would that have been?
You got the Riddler running around with question marks on him. These
villains but a dude running around with an abacus, like rattling every place
look
he goes.
Look at Chemo, or who's just a giant blob of chemical waste. Yeah, these aren't that far off from a lot of the more whimsical villains that we've seen throughout the past.
Oh,
it lets us know that some of those are probably still out there that we can see villains like that.
Mm-hmm.
And besides that, these are all supposed to be nobody villains, and that's really pushed.
Yeah,
that's really kind of listed in here because the Penguin's double crossing them.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, the real antagonist of this story, the true villain, in the final confrontation, even Batman tells her, look, you're done playing with the big boys. This guy's out of your league. And she doesn't want to believe it until she basically gets schooled by him.
Yeah. That's one of the things I love is this arc has been focusing on who's the new Penguin and what his role is with Gotham and to make him a badass villain again.
Yeah. Which, and, I hesitate to call him a badass villain, to make him a relevant villain.
They've made him a mastermind.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they've been playing with that trope for a long time in the previous DC. So this actually isn't that far. But to have him bring in a really group of villains.
They never really got it right, though. Like, they never were able to make him anything other than he's this crime lord who knows everything that's going on, but he's basically just an information punching bag for Batman. And in this, he's actually a bit, I don't want to say even, but he's a bit of a challenge. You know, there is actually a little bit of
he's got
chutzpah to him.
He's putting pieces into place and thinking four or five moves ahead.
Yeah.
He's playing that mental chess with Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And this
book, but he's not even playing it with Batman.
He's playing it with the underworld, which is actually a bad thing for him because if reputation gets out of that, nobody's going to trust him anyways. So. Right. Yeah, there is a so is that problem that he's got to watch out for.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got to play his cards right to keep from getting the reputation of being somebody that's going to cheat you out of stuff. He's got, as well as, you know, proof that, you know, Batman can't trust him. Now, Batman can go to him for information, but he can't trust that information now.
Exactly. Well, here the other side of this, too, is I wonder if this will lead into bringing in these other criminal kingpin-type characters, like, say, Black Mask. And setting up that gang war. We haven't seen Two-Face yet, have we?
Nope. Two-Face, they kind of been teasing that we're going to see him soon.
Okay.
I don't know where.
So that'd be another good one of going back and forth and letting them really set up this sort of like a crime war in the city and where Batman will fall in amongst letting them duke it out, getting in the middle, you know, keeping people safe.
Well,
and how much he really can influence in that.
The Black Mask, I think we're going to see, and I think he is playing a behind-the-scenes role.
Mm-hmm.
They've been playing with the gang wars for a long time in the Batman books, so it'll be interesting to see if they let that lay for a little bit and play with some other aspects of Gotham, what's going on. Right now we got the Court of Owls going on, which...
And that's
going
to be encompassing for the next, you know, for a good long while.
And I'd actually be interested to see, you know, Penguin as part of that. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Cobblepot's been...
Yeah, big names
in Gotham for a long time, so.
But penguins aren't owls.
Penguins aren't owls, but they're still birds, and just because he didn't choose an owl as his moniker.
Doesn't mean he's not.
Yeah. He was named the Penguin, it was to make fun of him for being short and round and waddling.
Yeah.
As well as going, wah!
Yeah, so, wait, he did have a few wahs in here, I noticed.
Yeah, they like, yeah, which. They've done that in the comics before. They did it in the DeVito movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not unnew to the
character.
That's
funny you call it the DeVito movie instead of the Burton movie.
Okay.
Well, Burton did the first one, too.
The Bird, the Bat, the Cat, yeah.
Yeah.
The second Burton Batman movie, if you want, yeah. DeVito was, of course, playing the Penguin.
The truly dark Batman movie. The only really dark Batman movie, come to think of it.
You don't think Batman Begins?
The Nolan stuff was dark. But they don't hold a friggin' candle to Batman Returns as far as dark.
I don't know about that. The whole ones, I...
Okay.
Wait.
You got DeVito.
Yeah.
You got, Keaton. You have, Walken.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, Pfeiffer, whatever. You got Walken.
Walken.
I mean, not that he makes a movie dark, but he's gonna bring in the crazy.
Yeah, he does bring in the crazy.
Does DeVito to a damn good amount.
But you had a poodle catching a batarang.
Yeah.
You had a whole bunch of circus freaks going on in the middle. Burton just kind of lost his mind in doing that movie. That's why I think,
part of the reason why he wasn't doing the third one. How many movies have he done has he not lost his mind on?
When he's doing his movies, that's great. Yeah. If you want to watch Edward Scissorhands, if you want to watch Nightmare Before Christmas, or if you want to go pick up Sweeney Todd, let him do that because that's what he's good at. And Sweeney Todd's dark if you want dark.
Oh God, yeah. Have you seen Coraline?
I've not seen Coraline.
I need to see that one too. I heard it was really good.
But so back to actually comic books as opposed to old 80s, you know, Batman movies that ended with really bad Shoemaker remixes.
Oh boy.
I
Shoemaker, not Schumacher.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm looking to see where this goes. This has kind of been the action movie version of Batman for me. It's not as much of a big solid story as much as it is action scene, action scene, action scene. With here's a thread of plot just to tie the stuff together.
Well, but I will say one of the things that's different between this book and the Batman book is that for both of the two little mini arcs that have been in this one, they've had that, not necessarily whodunit, but although that was in there at in the first arc, but there's been a very precise focus in these stories on the crime, on what is it that's really going on, what are the motives, what's being committed. And Batman being there to prevent that from happening.
I didn't feel that much in this one.
Well, no, because he doesn't give a really that big of a crap about what the hell Penguin's doing with his little bee cronies that he's got going on. He doesn't care about that. He's caring about this other crime that's going on with these two interacting,
the two sisters and Snakeskin.
Right. What's going on with them? That's what he's following. That's the crime he's...
That's the clue that he had that brought him to the Iceberg Lounge. He didn't know about the other people at the Iceberg Lounge.
Well, exactly. But even when he does find out about it and everything else, he's being a detective. He's following the clues that he's getting to their logical conclusion.
I felt that it was a little bit... Well, the logical conclusion to have him show up at the end with the double and triple crosses going on, that didn't quite hold water for me. To have him show up... Yeah, to have him realize... This is the double cross here on the iceberg, but after they left the iceberg, where there's another double cross going on, have him show up there. It makes sense because he would continue to follow her.
Yeah.
But there's not, to have him realize, that.
Well, I guess what it is for me is the fact that this is a story that does have those double and triple crosses, whatever else. Those are the type of plot elements that exist in a detective story. And you're not seeing those things in the Batman title. The Batman title is its own. Very Scott Snyder story.
Yeah.
Which is very good.
And it has its own clues. It does drop little hints and suggestions. It actually drops clues and then you follow the clue to the next event.
Right.
Here, he's just kind of following a person that's going on as the events occur.
Yeah, I'm just saying the Batman book doesn't read like a detective story. This, I think, reads more like a detective story. There is lots of action too. But there are detective stories that have lots of action.
I think Snyder's is reading more as a detective story than this was.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. Because his has the whole surrealistic element to it. But
for the last couple of issues, but that's because...
You're at
the denouement of that story.
Yeah.
So you're not having to follow the clues anymore.
Knowing Snyder's work, if he's going to continue writing this, I think you're going to see things like that going in line too. Don't be surprised if Scarecrow shows up in Batman. Because that's the playground that he...
Oh, if you want Scarecrow, go read Batman the Dark Knight, because he's been in...
Oh, that's right.
He's been in there with Bane and...
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, basically, they've been kind of rehashing the entire original Bane arc, just not quite as well.
Okay. But what I'm saying, though, is Snyder specifically, that's his wheelhouse. That's where he shines. So don't be surprised if you see that stuff coming around again in further Batman books.
Oh, yeah, but... I think the first arc, from this Batman arc that Snyder's been writing where he's going, the Court of Owls, they don't exist. Oh, here's another clue that the Court of Owls do exist. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's the Court of Owls, here's the records that show that that these buildings were built to the 13th floor.
They built step by step
leading up to those last couple of issues where you get that really trippy effect and having to flip it upside down and having your iPad flip it back right side up so you can't read it.
You know, I wonder if he did that just to screw with people that got it in digital.
You just put it down on the table and you walk around the table to read it. That's how you have to do it.
Which just makes you feel more comfortable.
Or you flip the switch that keeps it from rotating. Either way,
technology be damned. Okay, well, next up book, going back to the Marvel side of the street, Ultimate Spider-Man number 8. The Ultimate Spider-Man has been doing pretty good so far with us. We've both been enjoying the story, I think.
Yeah.
The interesting thing in this particular issue is we now are seeing the dynamic between Miles and his uncle, both of them knowing full well who the other really is.
Well, Miles doesn't know his uncle's the Prowler. He knows his uncle's bad. Yeah, he knows his uncle's a thief. He doesn't know that he's a super thief.
Well, he knows that, as of this issue, he knows that his uncle is the one that stole the spider from Osborn Labs that got him bit. Yeah. Because his uncle flat out tells him that. So, to be able to get into Osborn Labs and steal stuff, you're not some, mook off the street.
That's true. But I don't think he quite grasps just how bad it is with his uncle yet.
Yeah.
I think that's still to be revealed, just how bad it is with his uncle. Which is fine. I like that new dynamic, as opposed to the uncle being the character, live your life right, do the right thing. It's now, don't be like your uncle. And I'm here, and even though he's not saying it, he's basically come up and going, I want to use you and the powers that you now have.
Yeah. It's the lead by example of what not to do.
Yeah.
Which is, you're right. It's a very interesting kind of take on it.
I also liked just a couple lines in here that indicate it, and it's a new facet to his relationship with Miles and his father.
Yeah.
And that's the fact that his father doesn't like superpowered beings.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got that whole dynamic of how does Miles tell his father, which his uncle's threatening to do.
Now, his dad is the cop, right?
No, I don't think his dad's a cop.
I thought his dad was the cop that was bringing him in at the end of the story. I thought that was his dad.
No.
Oh, okay.
No. But,
if it was his dad, that'd be really kind of stupid, because I know that mask doesn't have a voice changer on it. He could be talking to his dad.
Well, his dad may also just be trying to get, the cop, if it was his dad, I know I'd be going, bring him in and try and get him out before anybody recognizes him.
I'm gonna go back and double check. I think it's his pops.
I don't think so. I don't think his dad was in law enforcement. But again, back to the actual interesting part of that is, mm-hmm. it deals with the kind of, it's as if his uncle found out he was gay and his father was a homophobe, except for it's dealing with superpowers.
Yeah.
So he's got that fear of, how's my dad going to react? I know he doesn't like beings with superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
So when we tell him, I have superpowers, is he going to throw me out of the house? Is he going to stop loving me?
Or is he going to become maybe a little more accepting of something that he hasn't previously, and it'll help him maybe to become
Or will he accept me? Or will he, still understand but not accept? So, you're still my son. I love you.
Or accept but not understand.
But I don't, you're my son. I love you, but I don't want you to be doing superhero things. And it's still, the end of this story actually made me feel a little bit better because he's not quite got the handle on being Spider-Man yet.
Yeah.
Which I wish there was more of that.
Roll with that. How long is it going to be before he really does come into his own and it's like, okay, you are now really and truly Spider-Man?
If all they need to do is end an episode with Nick, or maybe even begin this next episode with Nick Fury pulling him out from the police and saying, he's with me, and giving him some actual training. I think that's what it really needs is, he's got the invisibility, he's got the spider sting, he's got the webs.
No, he doesn't have webs.
He's got webs.
I don't think he did. That's the whole thing. He was jumping from building to building. He never had, he has web shooters.
Yeah.
He got the shooters because he found the...
But so it'd be great to see, Nick Fury take him in and actually get the kid some training so that the kid can survive on the streets of Spider-Man. Because I'm having a... Even with all of his things, he's kind of gotten lucky, and we kind of see him, that luck running out at the end of this issue.
Right.
And it's about time, and I wish we could see more of him getting some sort of training or somehow to build him up as opposed to, let him get his ass handed to him, and maybe that's going to happen with the Scorpion. I love the Scorpion that they presented
here. Yeah, the way that they went with Scorpion in this book is fantastic. He's this...
He's a tatted out gangbanger.
Yeah, with a big honking chain that has a very scorpion-like attachment.
It's got it's got a big ass meat hook on the end of it.
Yeah.
That he just whips around. And the cover's misleading because the Scorpion and Spider-Man don't tangle at all in this. And the cover certainly shows them fighting. So a little disappointed that you don't see that. But the way that they've created Scorpion, I love to see what's going to happen with that.
I don't know if he made an appearance at all in any of the previous Ultimate books, or in the Spider-Man Ultimate Universe. I don't think he did.
I like this character, though.
Oh, I do. And I do as well.
But again,
I think it's a great direction for the character.
Maybe we'll see him show up, kick Miles' ass, and maybe that'll get Miles to train something. Because I'm just tired of him not having any training whatsoever.
Well, the whole thing, Peter Parker never trained. He never had any truly formalized training. He just went out and he got his ass kicked a lot. He was the punching bag of the Marvel Universe. Everybody knew this.
We're not seeing him getting his ass kicked a lot. And he's not starting off taking on bank robbers and such like Peter did. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a little lady getting her purse stolen, but other than that.
Well, Miles is coming in to a role that had somebody that did get the slow build, who could become who he became because of
the slow build.
Yeah, because of being able to do it that way. He's now being dropped center stage into the shitstorm.
Yeah.
So he either, like you said, needs to get the chops, or he's gonna have to figure out a way to kind of do the slow build without. He's gotten it so far with the luck, like the luck aspect has been enough, but he's gonna need to, I guess.
The luck has gotta run out, otherwise all of a sudden it's just like, oh hey, I'm the new superhero, I've got all these powers, watch me kick people's asses.
Right.
And to me that's not as compelling as seeing him, you know, all of a sudden the luck runs out, he gets his ass handed to him.
Maybe this will be like the interesting other side, cause the Peter Parker Spider-Man, like I said, was the punching bag of the Marvel Universe. Maybe Miles will be the redemption. He'll be the one that, like, always gets the lucky shift. The one that gets the lucky hit in.
I don't see it as the redemption, though.
Peter Parker is gonna be rolling over in his grave looking at Miles going, you son of a bitch. Why the shit couldn't that happen to me instead of me getting all the crap hands dealt to me?
I don't see that.
I don't see it being the case, but God, would it be funny. Especially if they even, like, comment on it.
It's too cosmic to really be able to view in this book.
No, but to see, like, Aunt May and Gwen, who were in Paris.
Which I did love to see them. I love that we're actually following Peter's side of the story.
But to see them come back, and to see Miles get the lucky shot, get the lucky break, and to have them get pissed, because they knew how hard Peter had it, and how difficult it was for him, and they see this kid, basically, it being handed to him on a silver platter, and having that conflict because of it. I think that would be fantastic.
Maybe they can make that work. I don't think it's going to be that easy. I don't see a way to make that work very well. And it's kind of a blast story, I think. It's funny, but that's about it. As a story, it doesn't.
It'd be a good subplot. It'd be a good, like underlining.
Again, I want to see the character grow. And I don't think if you're dropping him in there and he's kicking everybody's asses, he's not growing. Yeah, there's no growth factor there. So, they still have a little bit of leeway because he's new and they're playing with the fact that he's new to the role, but where's the progression?
Yeah, I suppose.
So.
I don't know. I'm gonna push for it anyways, because I think that's what they should do. I think it's hilarious.
Alright.
Last one we were gonna talk about was, Irredeemable. Which, I gotta say, I was surprised to find out I'm the only person at our shop getting this. That surprises me. Irredeemable is a fantastic comic. It's a great comic. It's a great story. The problem was Irredeemable had a horrible arc in the middle of it, where Tony's off in like the space prison with the aliens and that whole thing. That was just, it was garbage. It really was just absolute garbage.
Well, and when his parents came back kind of deal with the celestial creation of him, that kind of got a bit iffy, too. It was kind of, where is this coming from?
Yeah, I mean, his return to Earth was great. But then, and I would say the nukes at first I didn't really care for, but the way that they're beginning to incorporate it now, I think is really pretty smart. The celestial parental thing, again, is trash. But now we're getting into a point where we have Modius back on the scene as an actual villain. Being a villain and doing it well. But there's the continuing unrequited homosexual love between Modius and Tony. But now Modius is in a female body of a girl that
Tony's attracted to,
or at least was. But now it's sort of like, okay, but does he, because he knows Modius is in there and he's like not into that kind of thing. So, there's that whole kind of weird thing going on, but on top of all that, Modius continues to be just a damn good villain. In the beginning of this entire story, way back when, they said Modius was the only villain that Tony was truly scared of. Like, he actually made him worry. Yeah. And now I'm beginning to understand why. Because he can do stuff and play these mental games and do these just off the wall shit that it doesn't matter how big of a badass superpowered guy you are, he's gonna get you by the short and curlies anyways.
Yeah, because he's gonna make you look left and he's over on your right. Now
he does it over and over again.
He's a mental magician with the way that he plays these games.
Yeah.
And he really is pulling you in one way and then smacking you from the other side. Mm-hmm. So, he does have some great characteristics, and as a villain, he's doing a great job playing Tony that way.
Yeah.
And really, this is coming down to, yeah, will the entire Earth be destroyed by them, by the people, by Tony starting it off, and then the people trying to stop Tony to save the Earth, are they going to destroy it?
By trying to stop him.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, so there's a whole lot of chain reactions going on there, plus Modius going in because he
doesn't care about the Earth. He doesn't care about the Earth, he doesn't care about people, he doesn't even, I mean, the only thing he cares about is Tony.
Yeah. It's his love for Tony, that's what he's after.
I wouldn't say love, I would say obsession. His obsession with Tony.
Yeah, the other aspect of this comes in with the rest of the group of heroes that are off on their side quest with the Tree of Life.
Right.
They have the siege for the Tree of Life, and they brought up the interesting philosophical question of, you know, if we use these, we live forever.
Everybody lives forever.
Everybody lives forever exactly as they are, which means babies are going to stay babies. Mm-hmm. Old and infirm are going to stay old and infirm.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, the one character who is truly immortal, not Gilgamesh, I'm trying to think of his name.
Yeah, it's very similar to Gilgamesh. It's
like that.
Gilgamesh.
Yeah, something like that. But he is immortal. He knows what it's like to be immortal, and he's basically telling them, yeah, this will save everybody, but this isn't a blessing, it's a curse.
Right.
I know what it's like, and this kind of sucks.
Yeah, it's
which is why it can't be my decision, and he basically hands it off to Caden, one of the other heroes, and says, look, you're human, you're the one that's gonna decide this.
Yeah, and it also says it closes that door between life and death. So Caden, whose power is actually speaking with the dead, will be unable to talk with the dead.
Which, this is something that's kind of interesting in this book. Certain characters, like the Gilgamesh-ish, whatever the hell his name is, he hasn't been depowered per se, but his wings are gone. But you have Qubit, who's kind of still in a status of flux. You don't know if he's really powerful or if he's depowered, and it keeps going back and forth with him. Betty Noir, in this issue, got a huge power boost by Modius being in her.
Yes.
Anyways. What's his name? The twins that became triplets, Carrie.
Yeah.
Carrie's a ghost. He ain't shit now.
Yeah. And, yeah, Carrie will disappear if they use those seeds.
Because the connection between living and dead was gone, so.
This is really building a lot of, you know, questions in each, you know, making them put ethical decisions behind what they do to try and save everybody. Do we save everybody? In which case, we're all stuck exactly as we are. We can't die. We can't, and we don't continue to live.
Is it worth it to live forever? But even if doing that, it's still not going to necessarily get rid of the Plutonian, which is the real, at least they say, the real problem. And all it can end up doing is making all these immortal people live forever under the rule of this abhorrent tyrant.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it will serve. Protect them from the radiation from the nukes that had gone off when they freed Tony's parents. So there's
what is it that they're surviving for?
Yeah, there's will there be anything left? Yeah,
worth living for.
Well, will there be anything worth? Yeah, will there be anything left that you're living in? Because it'll kill plants, it'll kill animals. So now you're infinitely hungry for eternity.
Yeah,
because there are no plants, there are no animals, so you can't grow crops to feed yourself. You can't grow cattle to feed people.
Right.
Yeah. You know, you don't have, you know, you can't, you don't have ways, yeah. You know, basically, society's going to collapse, and you're never going to grow old and die.
Everything's in the shit.
So, yeah. It is a very bleak book right now. Yeah.
And I love it for it. That's part of the joy of this book. Yeah. I'm trying to remember if I heard that this was going to end.
Yeah, they have said that Irredeemable and Incorruptible, which is its sister book, are going to be coming to an end.
Okay.
I don't know when, but they have announced that the series will be wrapping up soon.
Okay. And I thought that was the case, I just couldn't remember.
I can kind of see where this book is going, and I think I know where it might lead to. But
I've got ideas.
And if that is the case, it kind of wraps up my whole thought of where this is stuff that's coming out of left field because he ran out of stuff to create. Abe says he may have at least had the idea of the way that it's going to arc. Maybe not necessarily the specifics of what was going to happen, but he knew the way it had to arc to get to the end that he wanted. And I think that's where it's going to end.
Okay.
But we won't know until we're done, so.
Okay. We have a couple news things to go over, but we're actually, I think, I don't know if we're going to have time to really get into them.
We got a little bit of time left, so, actually, one of the, things I want to talk about, Mezzet Shelley, the artist on the Batman Year One, mm-hmm. which had come out, they're actually doing a new, print of that.
Right.
And he's actually said, don't get it. They've changed the coloring, they've put it on glossy paper instead of matte paper. Find yourself one of the older versions of the book. This is just the publisher trying to make money. Yeah. And it'd be interesting to go into a discussion of, you know, what rights do the artists have when, you know, the companies that have done this, it's work for hire. He was paid by DC to make this book. It's not an original property that he sold to them. So what right does DC have to come back and make changes to the coloring or have it re-inked? Yeah. To put it out.
Legally? It's theirs. He made it for them. They can do whatever the hell they want with it.
Yeah. But, yeah.
I mean, unless there was something in the agreement that specified otherwise.
Yeah. So, there's also the part that he could have done it to come out and gone, you know what? When we did it with these, you know, these were the parameters that it was set to. We'd like it to continue being printed in those parameters. This is the coloring. Don't recolor it.
Yeah, I created this art for this medium. And who's the
Moore?
yeah, really, because, you know, he never wanted his stuff put into movies, because that's not what he wrote it for. He wrote it for comics. So he feels that that's not...
Yeah, it's a different... When you go to movies, you're now doing... You can't stop and flip back and see who was that masked man at the beginning of the book.
Well, one of that, he wrote it panel to panel. There's the gap between where the mind does what it needs to do.
Right.
And you don't have that in the movies. You instead, you have to actually create the transition between the two, as opposed to letting the human mind come up with something better.
Yeah.
But as far as this, I mean, legally speaking...
You're right. He's got nothing to stand up.
Now, ethically, if DC has this work, and the artist is telling them, look, I made this work to look this way on this stuff, you know, on this stock for a reason.
Yeah, fundamentally, it's changing the way you view and interpret his art.
Right.
So, do you have the right to...
I would say he has the right to bring it up. He has the right to bring the concern to them, and they should ethically listen to him.
He's not saying don't put out another edition. He's saying you've changed the coloring, you've changed the stock that the paper is on so that it's glossy instead of matte. We need to take a step back and say, these are changes that...
Are they actually doing it as a cost saving measure? Like they're trying to bump up their profit margin?
I don't know DC's side of this. I can't imagine it's cheaper to go back and recolor a book. That files are that they have bad copies of the digital files that the originals were created off of non-original works. And he's like, I got the original papers here. We can scan them in, create real, you know.
Well, how old is the Batman Year One book?
I want to say it came out in the 80s. Yeah. Because I'm pretty sure there was...
So it's possible that they just don't have digital copies of those. And so the format they had it in just doesn't afford itself to a good reprint because the deterioration or whatever else. They're not using the same printing method, so what they did have for it just doesn't apply anymore. And to make it work in their new processes, they needed...
And part of that is true, because they were printing on pulp. Everything was coming out on pulp back then.
Yeah.
So now they're doing it with...
If they're like, look, we print on glossy. That's what we do. That's what we have. So we had to do that to be able to use... maybe it is cheaper than to go and to buy the equipment to print it out on the original stuff that you were going to do. It's cheaper to recolor than to buy the machine. For one reprint of a book.
They could still buy a matte stock as opposed to a glassy stock. They don't have to go back to pulp. And the pulp argument, I'm kind of wondering, because we just both read Ferrest, which is a continuation of the Fables line by Bill Williams. That was done on pulp.
Which actually...
And there's a couple of other Vertigo books that I've read that are done on pulp. There's a couple of other...
Zombie is, I know. Which, but as far as I know, it seems to be pretty well contained in Vertigo. They're the ones that do a lot of the pulp work. DC, specifically, like their actual line books, don't. Marvel, as far as I know, doesn't. A lot of the indies don't. Ferrell's might, I think. I don't recall, but...
Yeah. And yeah, actually, he states it here, you know, they printed the color from corrupted, out-of-focus digital files. So, okay. Yeah.
All right, so that's his gripe, then, is that they're using suboptimal recreation. And I can understand the gripe in that.
Yes, and, yeah, you know, they should be able to get in touch with these artists, because a lot of them probably still have most, if not all, of the original works, or, you know, digital copies thereof. You know, maybe back then they didn't have digital copies, but they're now moving towards, you know, everything nowadays, I'm sure they're keeping digital copies of. Yeah. And they could probably get most, and, yeah. If you bring the artists back in, a lot of them care enough about their work that they want to see it put back out there the way that it should be.
Well, hell, I mean, they had enough pride in it to create it in the first place.
And same reason why you have, you know, movies where they're taking all this time to digitally reconstruct and rebuild.
Right.
The movies, yeah, from, they're taking the film, they're taking out all the scratches and the grains, they're recolorizing them so they're bright and vibrant like they should be, as opposed to faded as the film has gotten older.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. But you get it for things like, TNT did a whole bunch of these back in the day. I'm trying
TNT did the coloration, tried to colorize
they colored the film, which screwed it up, but. Yeah.
Well,
no, I'm trying to remember, because there was actually a commercial specifically for, like, some, musical that they were. Like,
you see them all the time, and whether
not
it's
Showboat, it was something like that, though.
So. I know they've done the Shirley Temples. They've done a bunch of those recently,
Like Oklahoma and.
Well, Disney will do it. Yeah, wait for whatever the next movie that comes out of the Disney Vault. I promise you, you'll see a split screen where they show you the original and then the digitally remastered version.
I wonder if they'll ever pull things like Pocahontas out of the vault.
I'm sure. Just give them time, because Disney will want to sell all of the stuff. That's why they throw it in the vault, is to let it sit so that there's a demand for it, and then they pull it back out.
Yeah, but
they could sell it again.
Maybe like that, I don't know if there's ever going to be any demand, though.
I don't know. People seem to like it when they put blue-skinned aliens and told the story. So, I'm just saying, when you add unobtainium and mechs and blue-skinned aliens, people will go watch Pocahontas. The story's the same. So, alright. The other big story was, you know, Archie Comics, who has been hitting a lot of social issues, over the past couple of months. They did Occupy Wall Street, which came out just this February. They were dealing with Don't Ask, Don't Tell and Gay Marriage, at the end of 2011, early 2012. They introduced the first homosexual character that was announced in April of 2011, and now they're actually dealing with breast cancer. So Archie's actually keeping themselves very relevant, dealing with a lot of modern.
But I think it almost actually is more of like them bringing themselves up to current. I mean, these are all, other than Occupy Wall Street, homosexuality, gay marriage, Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I mean, all three of those are all on the same topic. And it's a topic that has existed in comics long before April of last year.
Yeah.
I would say that they're keeping themselves relevant. They're bringing themselves up to being relevant again.
Well, but there are also things that are big in the media right now, particularly with the elections going on. You have a lot of discussion about gay marriage.
Yeah.
They did the Don't Ask, Don't Tell right in the middle of when the military was discussing getting rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah.
So, you know, it certainly does make it relevant. Yeah. And some of that is making themselves current, because some of these issues, yeah, we've had gay superheroes before.
Oh, yeah.
We got them now.
But maybe that's one of the things, though, is that Archie Comics is closer to slice of life than any of the Capes and Cowls kind of thing. So for that to take on these issues really does bring it, I suppose, a little closer to home in a more realistic kind of way.
Yeah, because it's how are actual people dealing with, as opposed to somebody that could just fly away from the problem or punch through a problem.
I would be hard-pressed to call Jughead, like, an actual person. Or Moose.
They represent a more realistic person, though, than
They represent a stereotype of person that exists in reality.
Yes.
Moose is the big dumb jock. We know guys that are big dumb jocks. We know guys that are big smart jocks. We know guys that are little dumb jocks.
Yeah.
It's the encompassment of that stereotype, which you can't apply, I suppose, to these other people that we do, in fact, actually know.
I don't know anybody that could leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Exactly.
So, it was interesting to see, you know, that they have been really pushing for that initiative. They've had a lot of internal struggle lately, with their editors, but, overall, they're pushing to make themselves relevant in today's world with those. And they are an all-ages comic book. You can pick that up as an adult. You can bring that and let your kid read it. And so it brings these items to a younger audience because, and it makes them accessible for younger. So as a, you know, if you are, you know, somebody that's gay and you want to try and introduce, you know, whether it's an adopted child or a godchild, it's a way of presenting it.
Well, it's a way to get them into comics in a format, in a setting that they're familiar with.
Yeah.
So. Which, on the other side of that, too, you have kids that are reading these books that are being introduced to issues that some people may argue is too young for them to get involved in, and others may say, well, it should be a non-issue anyways, so introduce it in a fashion that they're just going to read it, and they may get it, they may not get it. If they do, they ask questions. If they don't, they gloss over it, and it doesn't matter anyway, because it shouldn't be made into an issue in the first place.
And if you really do have a problem with this, you skip that issue. Now, it is a bit hard because you have a gay character showing up continuously and dealing with, and, you know, but you can skip the gay marriage issue if you don't want to. They will still be married in the future issues, so it does make it a bit more difficult.
Well, here's the other thing, too, is that Archie, although it may have these topics in it, and the topics themselves may be serious outside of Archie Comics, this isn't exactly a dark book.
No,
let's be honest. It's a freaking Archie comic. It's gonna be yuck yucks and shitty puns and Betty and Veronica being catty at each other over a soulless ginger. So, I mean, it's not like we really have to worry about our kids being indoctrinated with a certain political viewpoint because there happens to be a gay dude that lives down the street.
Well, and it very well may just be a great way, because if you do have a gay dude that lives down the street,
well, here you go. Look,
now you can kind of introduce
reality
your thing to
being
it.
Represented in art. Go figure.
So, yeah, it's just, you know, where they're going with that.
Yeah.
Where we're going to be going is out of here.
Yeah, because we are over time, but that's okay, because you guys love listening to us anyways. And to listen to more things from us, you can find all of our contact information at about.me/comicbooktesseract, including our Twitter accounts. I am at Felix T. Cat, that's with a K and two T's. Jason is at J. Polyf. Our email address is comicbooktesseract@gmail.com. We also have a Google Voice account that's 50Tesseract, 508-377-3722. Our podcast is presented every week at thecomicbooknerd.com, and you can find us on iTunes. So, that is it for us for this week. We are, as we said, going to get out of here. I'm hopefully going to go get some sweet, sweet DVD action, and we will see you guys next week on the Comic Book Nerd.